been a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Tell Bruce and Felice what the heck that could be.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them and they just the exact same spot the whole time. They're out far, let me say that.
Oh my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Mark Weezer, are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc. UFOs over New York,
and I ain't too surprised. Well, it's a thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I'd gone.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange day indeed. Most peculiar, mama. Roll!
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello and welcome to edition 440 of Strange Days Indeed. Hey, we hit the quarter mile mark with this one. This week, the 3rd in May 2007, weekly editorial contributor Dave Furlott, Canadian documentarian Paul Kimball talks the best evidence, the top 10 UFO cases, and as he does every couple of weeks, Alfred Lemberg takes us home. These are Strange Days Indeed. And since we're talking the best UFO cases, I thought I'd mention that MSN has published its top 25 web-based hoaxes, and among many interestings, the number 13 slot goes to the Alien Autopsy film. The listing reads, number 13, Alien Autopsy at Roswell, New Mexico, 1995. Roswell, New Mexico, ground zero of UFO controversy. It's also where the movie of the Roswell Alien Autopsy was filmed 60 years ago. The story goes that a UFO crashed at this site, and the U.S. government performed a hush-hush autopsy on the dead alien. In the mid-1990s, unnamed individuals discovered the secret film and posted it for the edification of a disinformed public. Looks pretty real, right? Now fast forward to 2006 and a conspiracy-deflating admission. The movie is a hoax created in 1995 by John Humphreys, the animator famous for Max Headroom, in his apartment in North London. Or was it? Nah, it was created by American Computer Corporation, Billy Meier, Reg Presley, Cal Korf, Alfred Weber, Stephen Greer, Billie Jean King, and Sergio Mendez and Brazil 66. See what you learn when you listen to Strange Days Indeed?
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlock.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list that, quite frankly, I've done my very best to remain quiet on. The thread begins as just a few Roswell questions and has been going on since April 21. Removing my socks to help with the counting. In other words, it's been going on almost, for some 30 days now. Currently, the discussion is now centering around whether daylight savings time should be considered an issue about when somebody supposedly missed lunch. Oh, and it gets better. We have to concern ourselves with whether the sun was setting or not, and the angle of the shadows telling us what time it was. But as is correctly pointed out, that's only truly valid when you can determine where north is located. Now, all of this comes back to the very famous press photograph showing the non-flying saucer debris in General Ramey's office. And what truly throws me about all of this is that people are arguing over and over about whether the debris being held up by Major Jesse Marcel is something other than a weather balloon and some busted-up Rowan reflectors. Now, some people argue that the debris is cleverly disguised to appear like a crashed weather balloon. Some people are arguing about whether some real debris is mixed in with the fake debris that was shown to the press to throw them off the track. And then, of course, we have others that say it's the real thing, and that the crash was a weather balloon, and they know this because, well, that's what the Air Force tells us it was. So people have questions, and when those questions are not answered the way they would like them to be answered, they simply ask the same question with different wording. Now, I have questions about Roswell, and I keep asking them, but nobody has provided me with an answer that makes sense. I'm not saying I don't like the way they've answered my question. They simply haven't given me one. Question one, how is it possible for an officer with the rank of major in military intelligence not to be capable of telling the difference between a crashed weather balloon or Mogul balloon and a flying saucer? Two, did Colonel Blanchard issue an order to release a press release stating that they captured a flying saucer as a joke? Or was he hoping the story would keep the media away from investigating the much larger story about the crash of a top-secret Mogul balloon? Now, somebody out there has the answer to those questions. I don't know who it is, and I don't know who they are, but I do know that somebody knows. I also don't know what the answers to the questions are, but I really would love to hear somebody give it a try. For all I know, it could have been Blanchard, Marcel, Brazel, the town sheriff, and even Walter Hout sitting around enjoying the fireworks of the storm, swilling down bottle after bottle of whiskey, and they hatched up this great plan to collect the reward for getting evidence of some crashed flying saucer. Now, if memory serves me, the reward for that material was a whopping $1,000. You divide that by five and you get a whole $200 in your pocket. That's a fortune back in those days. Well, at least it's enough to keep the boys in booze for a few days. You see, the problem I have with Roswell is not just a few Roswell questions. Nope, not in the least. Just a few Roswell questions don't concern me. What concerns me are the answers. We don't need to ask more Roswell questions. We got tons of them. What we need are more Roswell answers. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
And your take this week, Dave Furlong, took it right out of my mind as I posted that thing about the time of day and whether it was central or was it summertime or was it Mars time or, and I thought, oh my God, the minutiae in this is just getting ridiculous.
Oh, it is. It is. It's like, I don't care what time it was, guys. And to be quite honest, I defy almost anyone to look at a picture and be able to tell me exactly what time it is without having a date and time stamp on it. Come on. Let's focus on some of the stuff that's out there that's a little more definitive. There is not a prayer that the stuff that was in Ramey's office was from the real debris field. It was brought in. They even admitted they brought it in to show that it was a weather balloon. That's it.
I don't know whether we've done Roswell to death quite yet or not.
I don't think we can ever do Roswell to death, basically because we don't have any of the answers. That's the point that I'm making, is we keep asking the questions and the same questions over and over again, but we're not getting any answers anywhere. When we think we might have some kind of an answer, it gets shot down completely.
That's the way it's going to continue, I have the feeling. We will never get an answer. Or will we?
Well, I hope we do.
Oh, I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I admire the patience of people like Kevin Randall and Stanton T. Friedman. who just climb in and point things out and fade into the background again until the next strange observation comes up.
They do it quite nicely. I have to give them the credit that they don't come in and go, squat, go away, you stupid idiot. We've answered this question 27 times before.
Yes, and it's all in the archive.
It is indeed, and that's what they should take a look at as well, is people should start going into that archive and reading it and reading it and reading it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there.
I'm sure the Roswell posts number in the thousands there now, out of the 70-something thousand that are there.
Thousands easily. Maybe even tens of thousands about Roswell.
Oh, God. Oh, no. Confuse the world. Cloud the issue with facts.
Oh, yes. What do we need facts for? Those are, what was it, what's Stanton's saying?
Don't bother me with the facts.
Yeah,
my
bother.
Mind is made
That's
up.
That's it. That's yeah. it. And the noisy negativists.
Noisy negativists and fossilized physicists.
I love that one.
Yes, if you don't know what you're talking about, shut up. Dave Furlott, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Talk to you next week.
For sure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Joining us on the line from his office, Red Star Films in Halifax, Nova Scotia, is documentary filmmaker Paul Kimball. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Errol, from all of us at the Red Star Empire.
It's been a month or two since we last talked on the program, if not much longer.
Yeah, no, I think it's, I was looking through your archives, I think it's last September, because I was on to talk about Fields of Fear.
Right.
And I was going to be on in December, I think, to talk about Best Evidence, and I got bumped, no offense, by Peter Davenport, because you had the O'Hare thing was breaking.
Yes.
So I think that was December.
And I felt badly about that, and I wanted to reschedule you for the radio program, and suddenly the radio program was gone.
I have that effect on people and things, so I'm sure I'm the proximate cause of that. I'm sure they said, Paul Kimball, oh no, you know, no more radio show. But you live on in the podcast universe, and frankly, I've listened to some of the shows you've done. The nice thing is they're cleaner and meaner and leaner, and it sounds like you sort of don't have maybe, not that you did have restrictions, but you can have more fun, just really get into stuff that you want to get into. So I actually think it's, no offense to the old show, which was great, I think the new show is an improvement.
I feel that way, too. We're uninterrupted by news and commercials, and I don't really have to worry about a boss, because this is the boss sitting right here talking with his own mouth at the moment.
Same here. Although, I suppose I have to worry about broadcast bosses. You know, we all have bosses at some point or another.
Mm.
But yeah, no, I know what you mean. There's something liberating to being master of your own ship and captain of your own soul, or whatever it is. So, yeah. I'm guessing you'd still rather be on the radio.
It's quick and dirty and over in 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, there's a lot of tidying and packaging and producing to do, so.
You become a documentary producer, sort of, for radio.
Yeah. What amazes me is that I'm cranking out, well, basically a 90-minute radio program with all kinds of interesting stuff and some not bad production values,
mm-hmm.
technology aside. And it's a one-man operation. I'm amazed. I'm personally staggered by it.
Well, as well you should be, because it's a fine program.
In the UFO field, you're known as a UFO documentary maker, and unless people have actually been to your Red Star Films website, they would not have seen the fact that you are making other kinds of documentaries as well.
If you look at the amount of programming I've done over the years, I've done more music-related programming for Bravo, including 2 seasons of classical music performance series a couple of years ago, and the next documentary that I'm going to be working on is also classical music related. I've produced or directed films on the blues and jazz and other stuff, and small town professional wrestling. So yeah, you know, I get introduced at parties down here, film industry parties, as the UFO guy. So it's not just UFO people who do it, it's people within the industry sometimes who do it. In fact, I got introduced to Jeff Regan, former federal cabinet minister, at a film industry Christmas party as the UFO filmmaker, Paul Kimball.
I guess it has a certain amount of cachet nowadays to be a UFO filmmaker.
I don't know about that. You'd have to ask my banker whether there's any cachet that goes to that. I don't think they're convinced yet. It's a subject I have an interest in beyond filmmaking and always did. So the fact that I can make the odd film about a subject that I like and actually enjoy is music is another one. I used to be a musician in a different life. So music and UFOs, it's nice to be able to make films about subjects that I enjoy as opposed to doing something like, you know, season 9 of Survivor or something like that. No matter how much it would pay, it's not something that I would be particularly interested in doing. Unless Mark Burnett calls me, in which case, hey, I'm there.
Maybe we can point him to this podcast and say, hey, Mark, go listen to this.
There you go.
Yes. So where did the scathingly brilliant idea come from to produce a documentary about the best UFO evidence?
The interesting thing is, in a very traditional way, it's not a documentary. It's the top 10, and this one or two UFO longtime researchers didn't want to participate because they didn't think that it had merit. It was designed originally to be a top 10 film, the kind of thing you see on Much Music or something where, hey, number 10, number 9, it's like a countdown. In a normal documentary, what you would probably do is either take one case and delve into that, or you'd take the phenomenon as a whole, as I assume David Cherniak is doing, for instance, and take a look at that as a rolling kind of story. But the top 10 films, it's very quick. You've got 4, maybe 5 or 6 minutes per segment, and it's hard to tell a story in 4 or 5 or 6 minutes and do it justice, especially, say, a complex story like the Tehran case or the RB-47 case. So in a truly traditional sense, I don't actually consider it a documentary on the one hand. On the other hand, the first thing my brother, who works with me, said to me when he walked in the next day, when I asked him, what did you think of the film? Because the first time he saw We Delivered So Late was on television that night. And he said, well, I thought you were going to make a flashy top 10 kind of film, and you made a documentary. So, you know, I didn't set out to make a documentary, but I guess in a roundabout way, once I got involved in the making of it, the idea was to try and tell stories and to try and have an overarching story as well. You listen to a musical top 10, hey, here's the Beatles, here's the Rolling Stones, and then here's the Grassroots. They're all separate bands with separate songs. And I just dated myself there by picking those three bands. But what I tried to do was provide an underlying theme to the film so that even if you were seeing like top 10 cases, and they're all sort of different in many respects, that there was a thread or two running throughout it. And as Dave Frelott mentioned on last show, one of the threads that you might be able to pick out is that the government, in this case in particular the United States Air Force, has some pretty goofy explanations for what some pretty good people claim to have seen. So how did I come up with the idea? Well, the idea basically, Errol, was it's hard to sell UFO documentaries. It's not impossible, but the market is oversaturated. There's a lot of stuff out there. Most of it, frankly, isn't very good. So it's always a mix, and you see this on your list sometimes with people complaining about documentaries about the UFO phenomenon, and they say, well, it's too much oriented towards the entertainment sector, and it's not serious enough, and it didn't take us seriously, and blah, blah, blah. And these are all written by people who have absolutely no idea about what it's like to try and produce any documentary. It's entertainment, folks. It's the television industry. At the end of the day, if you're not entertaining people, you don't have a job. Nobody in my industry would have a job if you can't entertain. The trick is, and what I've always tried to do, is entertain and inform. And space, here in Canada, kudos to them, has been very good over the years at letting me do a bit of both. So I thought, well, let's try and ramp up the entertainment quotient by doing a top 10 film, because space, which is also owned by Chum, which owns the music channels, they love that stuff. You know, top 10 monsters, top 10 crypto-terrestrial creatures or something. So here's the top 10 UFO cases of all time, and let's take a look at them and count them down. And that's basically how it came about, trying to meld the entertainment aspect with the informational aspect in a way that hopefully wouldn't offend anybody and might actually please not only the small group of UFO buffs, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but you know what I mean, the people who sort of are really into UFOs.
Yeah, seriously interested is
exactly,
all I have to call
that's
them,
what
yeah.
I mean. So it would please them, but it would also be accessible to the wide majority of people who might know what the term UFO is, but don't really care very much about it. It's not part of their day-to-day lives. And frankly, no offense to those folks that are really into UFOs, but I make films for that other group, the much larger group that maybe doesn't know as much. And you have to, because otherwise you're making a film for 1,000 people maybe, and networks tend not to want to license that kind of stuff. So There you go.
Once you got the skeleton together, how did you flesh it out? I mean, how did you come to the conclusion that the top 10 cases that you used in your film were a general consensus of what the top 10 cases are?
Well, there's a spinning wheel in my office with a number of darts. And so I just put all the case names on and I threw darts up. I polled or surveyed a group somewhere between, I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, 25 to 30 UFO researchers around the world, many of whom were willing to be known, and so they're listed at the back end of the film. A few others preferred to remain, as they say, sub rosa. They were happy to give me a list, but didn't want their names used for whatever reason. A few of them are people that have more or less retired from the UFO field, so to speak. So I took those lists, and I said, everybody, give me a top 10 list, or as Dick Hall called it, a 10 of the best, because Dick was quite right. He said, look, I can't give you the top 10. I'll just give you the 10 that I think are the best.
Mm-hmm.
And then I assigned points to each case. So if you voted Rendlesham at number 10, it got 1 point. If you voted Tehran at number 9, it got 2, and so on down to the number 1 case, which would get 10. Then I averaged them all together. And I said, well, the cases that got the most points are the ones with a couple of exceptions that are going to be in the film. There are some cases that I just thought would be unfilmable for any one of a number of reasons, would be tremendously difficult to film or tell the story. From the get-go, I said, if one of those cases winds up in there, then I will use my editorial discretion to take it out. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But one thing that did happen is I bumped the case that was at number 10 off the list. So it's really a top 9 with, and then an asterisk. And I stuck the Nuremberg 1561 sighting in because a couple of people had made the point to me, and I had already started to think that I wanted to make the point, that the UFO phenomenon predates 1947, which is the year that the vast majority of people, because of Kenneth Arnold and Roswell and other things, sort of look at and say, oh, well, UFOs, whatever they are, suddenly started appearing in 1947. So I wanted to start the film off by saying, no, they didn't. And here's a representative kind of case from the pre-1947 era, in fact, 400 years before that, almost. Mm. So, you know, I use my editorial discretion to do that, and if that sort of myths people, all I can say is the 10th case wasn't all that good anyway. I mean, who really wanted to hear about Socorro again? So, you know, I'm just kidding. Whatever case I bumped off, I can't even remember what it was now.
I was going to ask you about that, but then you answered my question. And
well, what was the number 10 case? Either Socorro or the Washington Flap of 1952. I'm pretty sure it was one of those two cases. Mm-hmm. Might have been Trindade. All three of those cases were sort of in the top 15 somewhere. And the truth is, Errol, the number one case, the RB-47 case, was so far head and shoulders above all the other cases in terms of points that it was easy. From 2 to 5... were in a different group, less than RB-47, but still more than the cases that followed them. Everything from 6 to about 20 was separated maybe by 4 points or 5 points or 6 points. I mean, they were all close. So at number 8, you've got the Yukon case in 1996. If somebody had shifted Yukon from number 5 to number 8 and pushed Washington from 8 to 5, then you would have had the Washington case in there maybe. So in a sense, it illustrates just the number of good cases that are out there. But to me, it also illustrated that when you start to winnow them down, there are about 3 or 4 cases, maybe 5 cases, that the vast majority of UFO researchers, knowledgeable ones, really focus in on and say, these ones, these are the ones that we should be taking forward. And those are pretty much the 5 cases that wind up at the top 5 in my film.
Have you had feedback from the researchers that were involved?
Dan Friedman saw it. He quite liked it. Dan carried the ball on a couple of cases. One in particular, the Yukon case. I really wanted to get out and interview Martin Jasek in British Columbia, and if I'd been there, I would have bumped up to the Yukon and had an offer to interview one or two of the witnesses from the case. And because of budget and timing constraints, just couldn't do it. Martin was helpful in the early stages, and I certainly would have liked to have interviewed him. Unfortunately, I couldn't get out there. You just have to pick and choose and make choices, and that was one of the choices I had to make.
Yeah.
But Stan, who has long been a champion of the 1996 Yukon sighting, basically stepped in and helped tell the story. So, you know, Martin would have been better, and I mean no offense to Stan, but Stan would be the first to tell you Martin's the guy who did the investigation. But, you know, Stan was an able fill-in. The other people who were in the film, to the best of my knowledge, haven't seen it. Brad Sparks, who was our historical consultant, and Brad, for the last year and a half, and I have worked very closely on this project, and I owe a big debt of gratitude to Brad for everything he brought. Brad saw individual case clips. So if with McMinnville, I would email him the case and say, here's what we've come up with. You know, what do you think? And he saw all the scripts beforehand for each case. But other than that, no, he's the only UFO researcher, other than Stan, I think, who's seen the film. Don Ledger apparently saw the last half of it.
Yes.
So he missed the Shag Harbor case, which is in the first half. There hasn't been any feedback. I will be getting DVDs made and sending them out to the people who helped us come up with the list, and some people who will review it as well, like Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop will hopefully review it for their website. The reaction will dribble in. But thanks to Dave Furlott for last week saying, what did he say? It was a magnificent film. Perfect. I mean, as a filmmaker, I mean, you just can't ask for anything better.
You,
so
no,
so thanks
can't.
To Dave for that.
And to go back to the Yukon case, I don't know whether you knew or not, or whether you caught it, but Martin had worked with a crew of documentary makers who made a film for the Aboriginal People's Television Network here in Canada on that case.
Yes, I was aware of that. The APTN, I saw a bit of it, I think, on the Internet, on YouTube or someplace. I caught a bit of it. One of the other things, too, that I was careful about was not replicating cases that had already been covered in depth. The Yukon case had already made it on the list, and that wasn't a problem. One case that, if it had made on the list, I probably would have removed would have been the Minot Air Force Base case, because I thought the Peter Jennings special 2 years ago covered that case in a short period of time, which is what I would have had, far better than I could have done. So at some point you say, well, let's assume Minot Air Force Base gets in and Malmstrom doesn't. Why, I'm just going to take Minot out and put Malmstrom in, because Malmstrom is a good case too. And I didn't have to do that because Malmstrom actually polled higher than Minot, but Minot was in the top 20. I think it was like 16 or 17. And early on it was in the top 10 and then sort of fell out. I probably would not have used the Minot Air Force Base case simply because Jennings, the seeing is believing thing, had already done it as well, as far as I'm concerned, as it could be done at this time. So what's the point of repeating myself?
An honest piece of reportage without too much monkeying around in the editing room. That segment, anyway.
Yeah, well, as I said 2 years ago, I thought the first half of the Jennings special was great, and I didn't mind the second half quite as much as everybody else did, but I sort of ignore it. So if I go back and watch it, I watch the first half, and then I'll watch Michio Kaku, and I kind of ignore the stuff on Roswell. And the abduction phenomenon or enigma, probably because those two things don't really interest me very much anyway. So I kind of skip over them. So.
Aside from the Yukon case, were there any cases that you dropped simply because of production considerations?
No. The nine cases that are in from 1 till 9 are the cases that were 1 to 9. I did switch two cases, number-wise. Didn't really make a difference. They were very close anyway. I will never say what they were, but let's just say I wanted to not run two cases from the same country back to back. So I moved one space forward and moved another case one space back.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it. Other than that, no, it was what it was.
It was a good was, too.
No, thanks.
I thought you did an excellent job and a very fair presentation. It was a damn fine piece of work, given budgets and time and the various constraints that filmmakers come across during the course of putting a production together. I thought it was damn fine.
Oh, thanks very much. Timing is always an issue, too, trying to squeeze 10 cases in. I heard Stuart Miller, our good friend, on your show last week, not complaining about being left on the cutting room floor, but actually saying he wasn't surprised. I would have loved to have kept Stuart in the Rendlesham segment. Despite what Stuart says, his clip was very good.